It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Solar panels are emerging as the cheapest method to produce electricity in many markets around the world. That's according to our next guest, who studies technological change and public policy's effects on it. There are a bunch of solar power development projects going on around Wisconsin of various sizes, and that's fueling hopes for cleaner and more sustainable power and for in-state labor opportunities. Some challenges are slowing the transition away from non-renewable sources, including investigations into Chinese labor that produced some of the panels planned to be used for Wisconsin projects. There are currently over 20 solar farms providing energy to utilities in Wisconsin, with more on the way, according to Renew Wisconsin. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about solar power generation in Wisconsin, around the country, around the world? Do you generate solar power on your own rooftop or where you work? What was it like to set that up? Do you work in utility scale solar power in one way or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Greg Nemeth is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, where he teaches on energy systems analysis, policy analysis, and international environmental policy. He's the author of the book, How Solar Became Cheap, A Model for Low-Carbon Innovation. Greg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be back.
I keep seeing reporting, Greg, about the surprising to some people acceleration of solar development. Is it going faster than you might have expected?
Yeah, I think it's going faster than just about anyone would have expected. It's growing, you know, in general about 30% a year, and it's grown that fast for about 30 years. And anytime something grows that fast, like that's like adoption of cell phones and things like that, you expect it to slow down. And that's what people have been predicting with solar for about the last 20 years, and it hasn't. It continues to grow at 30%. So that's why we have solar now becoming considered a potentially central part of the world's energy system, and including in our state as well.
What's driving that?
A few different items. The number one, I would say, is the continued fall in the price of producing solar panels. So they've come down about 90% in the last 10 years. And that also extends to savings in the installation of solar panels. So those have gotten cheaper as well. We also see people becoming more familiar with solar power and being able to talk to neighbors who have installed it already to find out who good installers are, when they would expect to get a payback, things like that. We also have supportive policy, and it's coming at multiple levels. We've got state policy that for a while has been there to produce some incentives for installing solar. It's stronger in other states, but we do have state incentives for that. And then we have a big deal about a year ago, the federal government passed the Inflation Reduction Act, so that created federal incentives that are available to Wisconsin energy consumers to install solar. So there's a variety of support for solar. The technology continues to improve. The pathway for continued cost reductions seems clear to most people, and it starts to look like you can configure solar to work with a battery in your basement that's also becoming inexpensive, and electric vehicles that are also becoming less expensive. And so there's a variety of ways that solar is coming into people's lives, in addition to larger scale installations from companies and utilities.
An early knock on the idea of solar power in Wisconsin is it's Wisconsin. We don't always have sun. We have snow that covers things up from time to time, shorter days in the winter with less sunlight. What have we learned over the last couple of decades about whether solar is really viable here in the state?
Absolutely. That's the number one concern people raise. And some of the evidence that you can see that there's ways to address those concerns are look at where solar has been installed. And it's been installed in lots of not that sunny places. You know, the biggest installer of solar for the last 10 years has been China. And northern China isn't that much sunnier than Wisconsin. If we look at Germany, the first large market for solar, that's got less sun than Wisconsin. And same for Japan. So we have examples of places that have installed a lot of solar without a lot of sunshine. And in the last 5 years, we've seen in Wisconsin quite a few companies that are interested in developing solar in Wisconsin. So you can make money installing solar, even in a place that's not the sunniest in the world, like Wisconsin. And then the answer to how you go from being a little bit of solar to potentially having solar being a large part of the whole energy system is that you integrate solar with other sources of energy. So you can have grids, like a transmission and electric grid that connects solar to other places, so that if you have a thunderstorm come over and cover up one area of the state, another part of the state that's connected can be producing solar. So that's one soft way to do it. Another stronger way is integrating solar with other types of clean energy, like renewable or like wind power, where solar and wind are not that well correlated. So it might not be sunny, but it's still windy, and that can be in the winter and night especially. And then other types of clean energy, like nuclear and geothermal, can provide part of the system when solar is not available as well. So if you start thinking about it from a system level, where we've got lots of different interconnected sources of electricity, solar makes a lot of sense, even if we don't have to depend on it 100% of the time.
Talking to Greg Nemeth, professor, UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at the rise, the exponential rise of solar power around the world and big in Wisconsin. A lot of utility scale projects in the works or actually online right now. A Badger Hollow Solar Farm in Iowa County on the way, Two Creeks Solar Park in Manitowoc County. Greg, what are you watching for when you look at these utility scale solar projects, solar farms, whatever we want to call them? Are we getting bigger and bigger in Wisconsin?
So those two that you mentioned are the two big ones we have in the state right now. So they're, on the order of 200 megawatts each. There's a gas power plants on the UW Madison campus. It's a little bit less than that. So we're talking about a substantial power station. What I guess the first thing I'd look at is that those were built. So this is when we're talking about like 5 years ago. Solar developer companies started saying, look, Wisconsin's got resources there. There's space, there's demand, there's enough sun, and we can make money building large scale solar there. So those two have gone in. So that was to prove that Wisconsin's a place that you can do large solar, that there's a place to do business there. That the panels work with the amount of sunshine, that it's interconnected with the grid, that the regulators can make it work. And so a lot of things have been proven with those first two large scale systems. As we go forward and we're thinking about more systems of that scale or potentially larger or smaller than that, the two things that I would look at as being really consequential are one, grid infrastructure. So making sure that there's ways that new projects can get connected to the grid and provide electricity to a variety of consumers that might use it. That's number one. And number two is the siting and permitting. So making sure that those who live around the facility have a voice and that their concerns about the aesthetics or the construction effort that goes into it are heard and that they're addressed. And there's things you can do with large solar farms like those two to make them work better and make them work better for the community. And so community engagement's a really important part of it. And that going forward will be increasingly really what determines whether the state has a little bit of solar like we do now, or a lot of solar, which is what a lot of states are moving towards.
Let's bring on a caller. David is with us in Verona. David, hi.
Hi. I was just going to tell you about panels that I installed on our roof about 5 years ago, or I had them installed.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about? How did it go?
Well, it was very easy. We went through a place called Focus on Energy, which is an advocacy group for solar power. They recommended an installer who came out to the house and very quickly and easily installed 15 panels. At that time, it was about $1,000 per panel, but I think it's a lot less now. So the total cost was $15,000. We got $6,000 in government rebates, a tax rebate and a incentive payment. So it was $9,000 total cost. In the 5 years that I've had it, we've saved $1,000 a year on electricity costs. So we've already paid off more than half of the actual price of the panel.
David, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Greg, how big a part of the story is personal, rooftop solar like David has?
Oh, that's great to hear from David about that. And I would just, as he suggests, the prices have come down substantially in the last 5 years with the Inflation Reduction Act, a similar level of incentive, about a 30% tax credit, so like similar to what he got 5 years ago, is available. And yeah, I mean, the big difference between large scale solar that we were talking about a couple of minutes ago and rooftop solar like David has is that David can tell his friends and his relatives about his experience. He can tell about an installer that worked well with him. He can talk about his energy savings. He can talk about any problems he had. He can warn about installers that might not have worked out so well. And I think that's something that my own research has proven really impactful. And we call it the academic jargon are peer effects, where you're getting information not from a company, not from a university, not from something you read online, but from friends and relatives, so trusted sources. And that's a really important conduit for any new technology to get over the unfamiliarity of having solar panels on your roof and not knowing who to call. So I think David's story is exactly why we see solar spreading in a way that kind of comes from clusters, because people know each other, and it's much more likely to have solar installed within a mile of another installation because of exactly stories like David's that that give people a conduit to trusted information about it.
Thanks for that call, David. We're talking about advances and obstacles in solar power generation in Wisconsin and beyond. Greg Nemeth stays with us, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. He researches public policy effects on technological change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about solar power, in Wisconsin in particular? Do you work in the solar or renewable energy sectors? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a solar production facility near you? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about the development of solar energy here in Wisconsin, how it compares to the rest of the country and the world. Greg Nemeth is with us, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, solar energy expert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. In 2005, we put a 3.8 kilowatt a PV array on the roof of our garage, and also solar hot water. The array cost, I think it was $30,000, and we got $10,000 in rebates, so it ended up costing us $20,000. And currently, we're in the process of adding just a little bit more than doubling our PV generation. And that we're going to be adding more panels to the racking on the, expanding the racking and adding more on the garage. And plus we're adding a new kind of panel that is to the roof of one roof on our house that they're about 6 inches off the roof. And they each have their own inverter. I'm not real averse with all this, but anyhow,
gotcha.
We're in Sturgeon Bay. We have a city-owned utility, and we have a grid intertie, we have net metering. So when we're generating, we run our meter backwards, and when we're drawing from the grid, we run forward.
Stella, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your experience. And Greg, yeah, how we integrate a rooftop project like Stella's with our local utility, it's been the subject of some controversy in our state laws. What do you look for when it comes to, you know, can people like Stella effectively deduct from their energy bill when they're selling electricity back to the utility?
Yeah, key issue. But first of all, Stella is a heroic early adopter. If we think of solar in Wisconsin in 2005, that was really one of the first couple hundred systems probably. And so if she and her family are going back to the solar market to upgrade and expand, they're going to find a much better set of panels and much cheaper prices than they did. So that's really impressive. But yeah, it's technically not an issue. We know how to connect a system to the grid. The issue is really on the financial part, and the financial part comes from regulations, because regulators decide, the Public Service Commission decides what we pay for electricity, and they also decide how something like solar gets handled in terms of, do we just pay people to run their meter backwards if they make extra, or do we say it's actually worth even more, like mid-afternoon last Wednesday when it was in the 90s and everybody's using air conditioning, maybe you actually want to pay more than the grid price at that period, or do you give people less than the grid price, which could be the way things are going as well. So there's a few different reactions to how those rates work out. One reaction is if the rates are kind of not as generous to providing net metering, we get less solar. But we might end up in that case getting people starting to get serious about putting batteries in their basements or taking advantage of a much bigger battery than they could ever put in their basement, which might be in their electric vehicle, and start to store some of that electricity instead of selling it back to the grid at a low price. So there's some pretty important incentives that come from the rates that people get for what happens to the electricity that they don't consume directly.
Thanks a lot for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Greg, I mentioned earlier some federal investigations into how some of our solar panels are produced, many of them in China. There's federal regulations saying, hey, we can't import products made with forced labor in China. There are some solar panels, I understand, waiting for installation in some of these Wisconsin projects, pending the results of that kind of investigation. How big a problem is this and the wider concern about relying on China for a lot of this technology?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've looked into that a fair amount. And the issue is that some of the input material for solar, a lot of it comes from a province in western China called Xinjiang, where there is forced labor. It's not clear that they're using forced labor in those facilities, because to do that process is mostly about these large furnaces. It isn't very manual intensive, but regardless, there's an issue there, and we don't have transparency from China or from those companies. So there's reason to be suspicious. But the bigger issue is that China's producing 70% of the world's solar panels. And so the question is, does that put us, the US or other countries as well, in a situation in which we might be similarly dependent as we are on oil producers? And I would say right away, it's not the same thing as oil, because solar panels last a long time. So if China cuts off our solar panel supply, we've still got all our existing solar panels. So it's not really a good comparison that way, even though people make that comparison. But we are seeing, because of the federal incentives in the last year, our much more production of domestic solar panels. And so it's not as big as what is being done in China right now, but it's enough to make a difference. And it's enough for China to ever think twice about cutting off our solar supply, because now we can credibly say, you know, if we get cut off from solar panel supply, we can start to make our own because we have something already and we could scale it up in a couple of years. So that's been a big difference over the last couple of years. We're going to have much more domestic manufacturing and getting panels from places other than China.
Talking about the rapid rise of solar power here in Wisconsin and beyond with Greg Nemeth from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. There's a building construction issue that I can't seem to get anybody to understand. A flat roof on a building serves two purposes: to keep the water and snow out and to keep the heat in. Roofs generally last 20 years. Some of them go 30 years. When those roofs need to be replaced, nobody's calculating what it's going to take to pull off those panels, put a roof back on, and replace the panels. That's something that people who are in the roofing business can't seem to get an answer to, and I'd like to find out if your guest has any thoughts on that.
Mike, thanks for the call. And I've wondered about this too, Greg. I know roofs have another purpose, and they don't last forever, like Mike says. Are we factoring this into the rooftop solar side of the conversation?
Yeah, well, it certainly saves costs to do the roof and the solar panel installation at the same time. So if people's timing works out, and typically, even if it's close, it makes a lot of sense to do your new roof at the same time you're doing the solar, because, you know, a modern roof could last 10 to 20 years and solar panels are guaranteed for 20 to 30 years. So most of that, if you do it at the same time, you're likely to be on the same time schedule for it. If you put new solar panels on an old roof, and then you need to replace that roof before the solar panels are done, yeah, you would have the cost of removing the panels and reinstalling them, which, you know, could add, I don't know, $1,000 or $2,000 to the cost of the system. So the timing of your roof and your panels is something to take into account. And if you can do them at the same time, it's definitely a good way to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. Greg, a lot of our callers, not surprisingly, interested in personal rooftop solar. When it comes to the utility scale projects we were talking about earlier, are there obstacles you see out there that we're going to have to overcome to continue this rise of solar power in the country?
Well, you know, part of it is there going to be demand for more electricity, because these are big systems. So if we're adding to capacity of the grid, are we going to need that? And our electricity demand has been pretty flat for the last 15 years or so. So that could be one thing that halts it. But on the other hand, we have this looming source of new electricity demand, which is electric vehicles. And we have less than 1% of our new vehicles in Wisconsin are electric vehicles. But in the rest of the country, it's more than that. In other countries, it's closer to 25 or 30%. And that's likely to be the direction that we go as well. So there will be a new source of demand for electricity, which is electric vehicles. And so we're going to need more generation, and solar is a good solution for that. So that's part of the answer. I think that the two big limitations, I would say, are one is on permitting and siting. So making sure that communities are supportive of the facilities that get planned, because they do take space, they take time, there's construction involved, but then they run silently and without any pollution and without much maintenance at all for the next 20 to 30 years. So there's really a benefit after that initial period of disruption. And then the grid infrastructure too, just to the extent that new power lines need to be put in. And so those are also need community input and have aesthetic impacts, and people need to take those into account as well. But in terms of the technology and the need for a clean source of reliable electricity, we've got a lot going for us with solar. And if we start to think about integrating into a larger system that has storage on the grid, for example, when it's not sunny, when it's night, when it's winter, then we can see a lot more solar happening. And that's certainly what's been happening in the rest of the country as well. So the whole country's got about 4% electricity from solar, and we have less than 2%. So there's a ways to go for the state to catch up. So I'd expect more to come on solar in Wisconsin.
Greg, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Good talking to you.
That's Greg Nemeth, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. We talked to him today about ongoing solar power projects in Wisconsin. If you have a story to share on your rooftop or in your community, let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Multiple Wisconsin municipalities and residents have filed lawsuits this month against companies they say are responsible for PFAS contamination in their water systems. Residents in the town of Stella in north central Wisconsin announced a suit against paper manufacturers and the 3M company. The city of Eau Claire announced a suit against various manufacturers of products containing PFAS chemicals. And earlier this summer, the town of Campbell on French Island filed a legal claim against the city of La Crosse. That could also turn into a lawsuit. This local litigation comes as large corporations like DuPont and 3M are proposing settlements in federal suits over PFAS contamination. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has expressed his opposition to those settlements, saying they don't go far enough. Residents affected by PFAS pollution are left wondering what impact these suits could have when it comes to remediating current contamination and preventing future pollution. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these PFAS lawsuits in Wisconsin? Do you think lawsuits could help resolve some of the contamination issues? How should polluters be held accountable, if at all? Do you want to see regulation to prevent future pollution? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Tony Wilken-Gibbard is Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Why are we seeing this wave of suits over the, really, just the last few months here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think there are a few reasons for that. One reason, of course, is that PFAS are a significant concern in many communities across Wisconsin. They're spread throughout the environment. And more communities are realizing that they have significant PFAS contamination in their water supplies in particular. Another reason, I think, has to do with just the historical context of where we are in the process of confronting the significant environmental concern. PFAS are still largely considered emerging contaminants. And what that really means is not that they're emerging into the environment, but that our knowledge and our regulatory response to PFAS are still emerging. So, you know, it's not until very, very recently that some of our main environmental laws have been updated to address PFAS, and we still have a long way to go. And you know, I think another kind of just important background consideration here is the way in which our country deals with toxic chemicals in general. We allow companies to put chemicals like PFAS into the environment with very minimal and ineffective oversight. And the burden is on the government to prove harm rather than the manufacturer to prove that the chemicals are safe. So we have a system that isn't proactive. And then when we discover that a chemical is cause for concern, like PFAS are, it takes many years for our environmental laws to catch up. And so, in the absence of that regulation, one of the only ways that governments or individuals can get any kind of accountability from polluters is through civil tort actions. And the claims that we're talking about here are generally civil tort claims, and they're based on the idea that even if the use or the production of PFAS weren't directly prohibited or regulated at the time, which they weren't, the polluter, the defendant, knew or should have known that there was a significant risk here that PFAS could cause harm, and therefore they should be held responsible for compensating the people in the communities that have been harmed. So we're seeing so many of these kinds of lawsuits because right now, at this stage of our response to PFAS, they really are one of the only avenues. And indeed, you know, there is quite a bit of evidence to show that PFAS polluters knew for some time that the products that they were manufacturing posed significant health risks, and they withheld that information and continued to distribute them into the marketplace. And that's why there's quite a bit of power behind these lawsuits that we're now seeing.
And we've been talking in the past tense a little bit, but what is the current state of regulation when it comes to this class of chemicals in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's still evolving. Like I said, just last year, our state set a drinking water standard for PFAS. We set regulations for wastewater dischargers, excuse me, to limit the amount of PFAS that's being sent into surface waters from places like wastewater treatment facilities. But we haven't yet to see some of the main environmental laws that we have on the federal level, like CERCLA, be updated to reflect the fact that PFAS is a hazardous substance. So when it comes to holding polluters accountable, again, these kinds of civil lawsuits are one of the only avenues that we have. We still don't have a groundwater standard for PFAS in Wisconsin, which is one thing that my organization, MEA, is working on with folks from the Marinette-Peshtigo area.
One more bit of background on these chemicals. If we talk about something like DDT, that, as I understand it, is one chemical. When we say PFAS, it's a group, a big group of different chemicals. Is that part of what's making it difficult to regulate these chemicals, that it's hard to do them as a whole category versus individual subsets of that category?
Yeah, exactly. So the general approach is to regulate individual compounds, you know, specific compounds. And so far, we in Wisconsin, as far as drinking water, we've only regulated PFOA and PFOS, which are two of the most widely studied compounds. But we're talking about a class of hundreds of compounds. And that kind of piecemeal approach, where regulators generally don't have the power or choose not to regulate compounds or chemicals as a class, is again one of the reasons that the process of responding to these kinds of situations is so difficult. The other thing, you know, that I would say, and maybe we kind of just skipped over this, is as far as the extent of the PFAS problem, is that these compounds were manufactured and put into products for decades. Products like nonstick cookware, which folks may be aware of, firefighting foam, which is a huge concern throughout the state, also, you know, food packaging. So they were manufactured and distributed for decades. They don't break down easily in the environment, and so they're called forever chemicals for that reason. But because they are so ubiquitous in the environment, folks sometimes call them everywhere chemicals. So there is a huge challenge before us. As we've been talking about, these lawsuits are an appropriate initial step, but we have a long way to go.
Let's bring on a caller. Colette is with us in Eagle River. Colette, hi.
Hi. I was wondering about milk organite. If that is tested for PFAS, being it comes from the Milwaukee sewage system and is distributed all statewide through at least Menard.
Colette, thanks for the call. Now, this was in the news a couple years ago. A study found, claimed to find some PFAS chemicals in this particular brand of fertilizer. The company said there weren't significant amounts in there. Is this something that you've been tracking, Tony?
Well, that's one of the reasons why it's important to have surface water standards in place so that the state has the ability to regulate what the products, that the byproducts of wastewater treatment, including milorganite, but also including the effluent that goes into surface water. I'm generally aware that there is some level of concern about milorganite, and one of the more generally a concern here is the sludge that has been spread on fields throughout Wisconsin, biosolids, which are similar to milorganite, a byproduct of wastewater treatment that's used as fertilizer. And that's one of the main concerns in the town of Stella and the subject of their lawsuit, that a paper mill that was treating wastewater knew that, or should have known, that there was PFAS included in that sludge that was used as fertilizer in and around their community.
Colette, thanks for that call. We're talking to Midwest Environmental Advocates Executive Director Tony Wilkin-Gibbart about lawsuits over PFAS contamination in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to see Wisconsin residents, in some cases municipalities, suing manufacturers or other sources of these pollutants? How big of an impact do you think these lawsuits could have? Is this a problem in your community, in your local water? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Tony Wilkin-Gibbart. He's the Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. He's with us today to look at the impact that lawsuits could have on PFAS contamination here in Wisconsin, the class of so-called forever chemicals. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about lawsuits over contamination with this class of chemicals, about regulation, what it is, what it isn't? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Ernest is with us in Hayward. Ernest, hi.
Hi. You know, toxic chemicals that we know are toxic should be immediately taxed. You know, you can't ban every chemical, but you can tax something that's toxic. And when you tax something, you have less of it. And new chemicals that are being introduced into the environment should be constantly surveilled. And when it becomes obvious that it is toxic, we should shift taxes onto these toxic chemicals. It's a very simple way to allow the market to function.
Ernest, thanks for the call. Tony, is this a strategy you've seen of not outright banning a particular substance, but taxing it to limit its use, as Ernest hopes?
Well, historically there were taxes on industries that have caused contamination to fund Superfund and other remediation programs. So that has been a strategy that's been used. I definitely agree with the caller that we need more resources to provide proper oversight. And that's one of the problems that we have, is that it's impossible for the EPA to keep up with the number of compounds that are being introduced into the environment on an annual basis. There is just not enough funding and capacity to go around to do any kind of reasonable risk assessment. And as we talked about earlier, the way the system is set up is that the burden is on the government to show that something is harmful, and that can be a very intensive process, rather than on the producer to show that their chemical is safe. And that would be another way to just ensure that the cost of safety is borne by the producer or the manufacturer, if they were responsible for conducting the tests and showing that a product is safe before they put it out in the environment. So it might have, in some ways, a similar function as attacks, like the caller suggests.
Thanks for that call, Ernest. And Tony, Ernest mentioned surveillance, trying to find these chemicals. I understand there's some controversy over that in Wisconsin. The state DNR wants to be able to monitor potential polluters for PFAS emissions. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and other business groups say no, they don't have the authority to do that. What's the view on that from where you're sitting?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lawsuit filed, I believe, in 2022, last year, by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce to limit DNR's testing authority of wastewater dischargers. So there was, WMC filed a lawsuit about that testing. Events have kind of overtaken that controversy, thankfully, because we now have clear legal authority for DNR to conduct that testing and that surveillance, because we have that surface water quality standard for PFOA and PFOS on the books. The authority existed prior to that, as the Jefferson County court found in that lawsuit and sided with the state. But we kind of have a belt and suspenders situation now, because thankfully the law has developed in the interim. Another lawsuit that is really critical here is WMC's lawsuit, again, against the Department of Natural Resources over its response to PFAS. But this lawsuit is over the spills law. And the spills law is the main protection that we have in the state of Wisconsin against all toxic spills. And WMC is alleging that the state illegally considers PFAS compounds to be hazardous substances under the spills law. They claim that the state must go through a complicated rulemaking process to define PFAS compounds as hazardous before PFAS polluters are responsible for reporting those discharges and investigating them and cleaning them up. And that is a pending matter that is before the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that will have huge significance for how our state is able to respond to these matters and hold polluters accountable. It is a more efficient way of ensuring that there is accountability than these piecemeal lawsuits that have to be brought by individual municipalities or even individual homeowners and families. It's important that there be a statewide regulatory response to hold polluters accountable, and that's exactly what the spills law is. But it is under threat in this litigation. So we see all kinds of lawsuits. We see civil suits against polluters, and then we see industry groups that represent polluters that are trying to slow and weaken the process of a governmental or a state response to PFAS.
Let's bring things around to our starting point, Tony. Those civil lawsuits filed by communities or individual residents, often against companies that they allege are responsible for PFAS contamination. What is the bar they have to meet to establish that, yes, in fact, these companies are responsible and they have to pay for it?
Well, there are hundreds of lawsuits, they all have different claims and different facts. So I can't speak to the particularities of that. But I would say, as a general matter, we're talking about tort claims against responsible parties like PFAS manufacturers or companies that knowingly distributed PFAS. And so there, the real nub of all those claims boil down to that the company knew or should have known that it was creating a risk by distributing PFAS into the environment and profiting from the sale of PFAS-containing products. And like we talked about, DuPont, just as an example, had known for decades that there was ample reason to be concerned about very, very serious health effects of the PFAS compounds that it was manufacturing and putting into commerce, because even some of its own workers were experiencing very, very serious health effects. That, in 2001, there was a class action lawsuit in West Virginia, which is the subject of the movie Dark Waters, and there was ample evidence in that class action lawsuit about DuPont's knowledge. So it really comes down to, in these civil cases, the knowledge of the responsible party about the risk that they were creating to the people who have been harmed.
Thanks to our guest, Tony Wilkin-Gibbard, Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. He joined us to talk about lawsuits over PFAS contamination in Wisconsin, what they can mean for regulations, along with solutions to current contamination problems and prevention of future pollution. Now, the city of Milwaukee has organizations, ordinances, and policies aimed at trying to protect residents from lead poisoning. But as Wisconsin Watch reporter Farah Anderson reports, the city often fails to hold landlords accountable for lead hazards that are poisoning tenants and their families.
Milwaukee resident Denise Honegger is sitting on the porch of a house off Locust Street in North Milwaukee. It's her first house that's been lead-free in 6 years.
There is not one speck of lead in my house now. I'm so happy. I got tears in my eyes. I'm so happy.
She moved into a house in 2017 that had lead, and then another, and another, and another. Her daughter and grandchild were both hospitalized from lead poisoning, and each time they moved, they thought they were safe. But when their landlords refused to address the lead in each property, they left.
We were homeless and in a hotel for a year at a time. I paid out my pocket. Nobody was helping us. We lost everything in each house.
Almost 5% of Milwaukee children under 6 tested in 2021 had blood lead levels above 5 micrograms per deciliter. More than half of the city's residents are renters, and lead poisoning rates are highest in neighborhoods where more people rent. Last year, the city's Common Council created more penalties for landlords who don't comply with government orders to fix lead hazards by removing lead paint or dust. But from July 2022 to June 2023, the city's health department issued just 26 lead-related citations to city landlords. And a Wisconsin Watch review of city records show 9 of those citations were dropped because of out-of-date inspections. Michael Mannon is director of home environmental health for the city. He says many landlords fail to comply with lead abatement orders.
And the problem here is that it's a lack of willingness and engagement on the landlord's part to do their duty, because they're the ones collecting rent. They have to maintain the property.
The Common Council also tried to protect renters from retaliation if they complained about lead. But often, renters are too scared to report or don't know how to complain. And if they move out because of lead, landlords can sue for rent collection. That's what happened to Deanna Branch. Her son Aiden was hospitalized twice for severe lead poisoning from old paint in a Milwaukee rental property. Child Protective Services told her Aiden couldn't be discharged if she couldn't provide a safe home. She left the house and moved in with family that same day.
Instead of depressed and angry, I should have been upset that they were like literally trying to blame me for just trying to provide a house for my son. I didn't think about it like that at the time. I thought about like, oh my God, like I'm going to lose my kids. I'm a terrible mother.
For the city to order lead remediation, a child has to test at 15 micrograms per deciliter. That's 4 times higher than what the CDC calls a concerning lead level. At that point, the city will cover the cost of abatement. Brittany Shanick is a lawyer with Legal Action of Wisconsin. She represents clients in tenant-landlord lawsuits involving lead.
There's nothing to incentivize a landlord from doing that lead abatement up front, you know, out of their own bottom line.
Since 2011, the state of Wisconsin has passed several statutes making it difficult for cities to set up proactive rental inspections, which could catch lead hazards before tenants move in. Some municipalities like Eau Claire and Racine have still created rental inspection programs. Heiner Giese is a lawyer who represents landlords in the Rental Property Association of Wisconsin. Giese says Milwaukee could use similar programs to protect kids from lead.
The city just says it doesn't have the money to do those. That's the real problem, but they can do them.
Deanna Branch is now in a lead-free home. She formed the Coalition on Lead Emergency in 2018 to make sure other parents don't have to experience what she did.
So I just felt like as a mother, I was definitely failing him because I didn't know the answer. And as a parent, you want to know the solution. You want to know how to best help your child.
The Milwaukee Health Department says they'll be ramping up enforcement against landlords this fall. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Farah Anderson.
For more information about Wisconsin Watch's investigation into lead hazards in Milwaukee rental properties, visit wisconsinwatch.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm looking forward to this. I was just at Aztalan State Park a couple weeks back. It's got a super interesting history. Learn all about it and a unique meeting of cultures here in Wisconsin 1,000 years ago. Join that conversation. Listen in tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. The internet can be super handy when it comes to repairs, figuring out how to use stuff, finding a manual or a user's guide. I've had good luck finding instructions to help repair audio equipment, use software, reprogram TV remotes, and more. But why stop there? What if I needed to fix my favorite 30-year-old pinball game? As linked at Metafilter, there's a showcase of old manuals collected online at archive.org. Maybe you want to operate the monorail at Disney World in 1959 or Disney's Haunted Mansion in the 1970s. Learn to fly NASA's Saturn V spacecraft in 1969 in just 243 pages. If you find yourself in possession of a 1924 Victrola record player, you're in luck. And if you're lucky enough to have a Pinbot pinball machine, learn all you need to know. That's just a sample. If you search for the manuals showcase at archive.org, browse over 70 manuals out of the millions available. Oh yeah, one more highlight, a manual for taking care of your pet rock. If you're too young to remember the brief pet rock fad, good for you. No need to explore further. This is Central Time.